You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hi, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 100. Just a note, today's subject matter may be a bit too heavy if you have little ones in the car. The last show was all about Dillard University. Located in the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans, Dillard University is a historically black university that's celebrating its 150th anniversary. I grew up close to Dillard, but I really didn't know much about it, and I decided to fix that by visiting the campus. We learned a lot about Dillard's history, the impact of its graduates in so many fields, the effects of Katrina, and a whole lot more. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Today's episode is about a tragedy that's mostly forgotten. It took place in St. Bernard Parish, downriver from New Orleans. It happened in 1868, a time of lots of upheaval in New Orleans and across the country. Dozens of people were murdered, and yet almost no one knows the story today. But you soon will. Before we jump into that discussion, I want to tell you about two of our sponsors who make the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast possible. If you're listening to this podcast, it's a good bet you love New Orleans, and I have a great way for you to explore the city, a Two Chicks walking tour. My friend Christine Miller's company offers small, intimate tours that are a fun way to get to know New Orleans better. Marie and I went on their Garden District tour a while back, and I loved hearing about the history, the architecture, and the residents, past and present. I still look for John Goodman every time we go past his home. Lafayette Cemetery in the Garden District's closed indefinitely for repairs, so if New Orleans cemeteries pique your interest, try their tour of St. Louis No. 1. With Halloween right around the corner, I'm intrigued by the Two Chicks' Dead Sexy Tour. It combines a visit of St. Louis Cemetery No. 1, followed by a discussion of the notorious district Storyville, which we discussed back in episodes 34 and 35. Whatever you choose, know you're going to be in great hands and you'll have a wonderful time. The team at Two Chicks is continually learning more about New Orleans, which means the tours are constantly evolving. Use code BEYOND and save 15% over at twochickswalkingtours.com. The most frequent questions that I get are about moving to New Orleans. If you are ready to make the move, you need a good realtor, and that's where Liz Wood comes in. Let Liz and her team over at Liz Wood Realty help you find the right place. They can help whether you plan to rent or purchase. Look, New Orleans is a terrific city, but choosing the neighborhood that's the best fit for you can be overwhelming. Liz breaks it all down and makes the process fun and easy. Uptown, downtown, by the lake or near the river, mid-city, the 9th Ward, Araby, Liz can help you sort it all out. Reach out to Liz at lizwoodrealty.com and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. Several members of our community have done just that, and they're thrilled with their new homes. You will be too. With that, let's meet our guest and learn about the 1868 massacre in St. Bernard Parish and the things that led up to that event. My guest today is an educator, a teacher, an author, and a native of St. Bernard Parish, which is just downriver from New Orleans. We're going to talk about all those things in their intersections as they play a part in the story I want to talk about today, which is a largely forgotten part of history. We'll get into all that. Welcome to the podcast, Chris Deere. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about this saga.
So thank you for doing this again. You guys won't ever hear it, but we recorded this and then we had a technical glitch, so we get to try again. Hopefully it'll be as good as the first discussion,
Chris. I hope so.
So again, the reason that I wanted to talk to you is you've written this wonderfully interesting book called The 1868 St. Bernard Parish Massacre. And we're going to talk about that actual event and what that means, but I kind of want to set the stage for that. And to do that, I first want to talk about you and where you fit in. So you live here in St. Bernard Parish. Did you grow up here?
So I did grow up in St. Bernard Parish. I grew up in Violet, which is a community downriver from where we are now. I lived there until I was about 10. Family moved to Chalmette. Katrina hit when I was 17, so I moved to Texas, finished high school, went to college in Texas, and as soon as I graduated, I moved back to St. Bernard Parish and started teaching, which was, I followed in my mother's footsteps. She was a teacher, And it was when I was teaching middle school at St. Bernard Middle that I came across this story and started doing the research. I was always trying to bring the content of trying to get my students, you know, engaged and involved by bringing their history to them. So I was always researching, because the more of it is theirs, the more, you know, the more they take ownership of it, the better they get at becoming, you know, historians.
So let's talk, just to sort of orient our listeners, where is St. Bernard Parish and Chalmette relative to, say, the French Quarter?
So the St. Bernard Parish is downriver from New Orleans, so it's southeast. If your listeners are in, you know, the South Louisiana area, they know what I mean when I say upriver and downriver. And at St. Bernard Parish, we say up the road and down the road.
Yeah.
So it's down the road from New Orleans. It's southeast, and if you follow the Mississippi River, it's on the east coast of the Mississippi River. The last neighborhood that you pass to get here is the Ninth Ward, if you're taking, you know, some the older highways, and then you get into St. Bernard Parish.
Yeah, and we're really only just a couple miles at best from the edge of New Orleans, right? And
right.
And really only a couple miles further from the French Quarter,
right?
And we should also mention, if you've heard my earlier, quite a while back, I did one an episode on the Battle of New Orleans with our friend Ed Branley, who also has a podcast.
I'm a huge fan of his.
NOLA History Guy. But Chalmette Battlefield is, again, just a little bit further into St. Bernard Parish than where we sit. So we're sort of, if you've listened to that, if you've been maybe to the battlefield, we are between New Orleans and the Chalmette Battlefield.
Correct.
And you mentioned that at the time you were working on your book, you were teaching at the middle school here in St. Bernard.
Right.
And that, it turns out, has a real tie-in to the story that we're going to get into.
It does. The middle school, St. Bernard Middle, is actually on some of the grounds where the massacre took place, because it took place over a large area. And a lot of my students have the same last names as the last names that are in the book. So I teach a lot of the descendants of both the perpetrators and the victims of this event.
You mentioned, we talked almost in passing, that you are an educator, but you were very, very recently, we're recording this in September 2019, very recently you were named as the 2020 Louisiana Educator of the Year. So you're not just a teacher, although any teacher is fabulous, but and one of the things that you're known for is this idea of really trying to immerse and pull history into a way that's relevant for your students.
Yeah, you know, it's been a wild ride being named the 2020 Louisiana State Teacher of the Year, and I officially start that in January. But I try to teach history in a way that's interactive and fun. I try to bring in as many sources as possible that's relevant to their lives, and pose questions and give them historical documents to analyze and synthesize, and we debate and we try to figure out what really happened, instead of, you know, me just up there speaking and them, you know, taking notes and getting bored that way. I try to make it come alive as much as possible.
Well, and I know you and I were talking off air that you sort of shy away from being called the historian.
Right.
But it seems that that's what you try to encourage your students to be, is to really be sort of a digger, a historian into the past, so that they more fully understand it.
Right. I definitely want to create historians in the best way possible. I wouldn't label myself that, but I want them to do what historians do, and they do research. So I want my students to do their research as well. And they have to take things into account, like bias and historical context, and they have to corroborate sources and try to develop their own narrative about what happened. But yeah, I try to give skills that can be applicable to history class, English class, and even outside of the school, because we are always analyzing and processing information. It's never, well, we should be at least, it's never going to end.
And we're going to get to your book, but one of the things that I'll mention right now that jumps out about the book is you intentionally label it the 1868 St. Bernard Parish Massacre. And you talk about what triggered it as you're talking about your students and getting them to question and look for historical biases. When you read there's not a lot of records, as we'll talk about, but when you read about the St. Bernard Parish Massacre, if you find anything, you will find it referred to as a riot. And it's very similar to, there was another thing in New Orleans called the Battle of Liberty Place.
Right.
Battle and riot were just sort of ways to soften up what in both cases were essentially massacres.
Exactly. And in the past, when I was doing research and the documents that I did find, often labeled it a riot. And I think what we think of when we think of a riot is two sides chaotically exchanging blows in some spontaneous manner. But it was anything but that. It was systematic. It was very calculated in how it was conducted and when it was conducted. And this happened time and time again in all throughout United States history, but it's specifically in Louisiana. We saw Colfax, which in the 1870s, there was a massacre there, which was deadlier than this one, and that was labeled a riot as well. Same thing in Opelousas in 1868, there was a massacre there. And a lot of these instances were called riots, but as we change our, you know, as we have changing interpretations of history, the study of historiography, we can revisit why people labeled it the way that they did, and in part is because they had a bias and they didn't want to label it a massacre because that would give a very different view of what happened. So now Colfax riots, they're known as Colfax Massacre, the Opelousas Massacre, the Thibodaux Massacre, and St. Bonaparte Parish Massacre. It's a more accurate term to describe what happened because it most certainly was not a random riot.
Well, and you're educating your students and our listeners to sort of look for that historical clue. Mm-hmm. As you now go back and look at history and you see the word riot or the word battle, particularly in that context of South post-Civil War, often it doesn't mean what the word would mean to us today.
Right.
As we get into, and your book gets into a very specific point in time in 1868, and I want to walk listeners through that, but I want to first sort of set the context of, we mentioned geographically where St. Bernard Parish is, but I want to talk a little bit about the significance of it in a historical perspective, really going back to the days before Louisiana was the Louisiana that we think of today.
Right.
And maybe we should start with the Spanish influence here and the population there. Maybe people don't know about that. So let's talk a little bit about the Islanos. And again, I'm still screwing that up. Islanos population and who they were and how they fit into St. Bernard Parish.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people associate Louisiana with French culture and French history, which of course it has a rich French history, but it also has a Spanish history associated with it as well. After the French and Indian War, Louisiana became part of Spain. So France ceded it to Spain in 1763. And the governor, Bernardo de Galvez, wanted to bring Spanish speakers into St. Bonaparte Parish. So he recruited people from the Canary Islands, which Isleños is the Spanish word for islanders, to come and settle throughout Louisiana. And one of the most populated communities was in Lower St. Bonaparte Parish. So we still have a huge Isleños population here. And I teach students with the last names of Nunez and Torres and a lot of names that go back and show our Spanish culture and Spanish background, which is really rich to this day. There's an Isleños festival down the road, and there's a museum complex. There's a lot of history there that's fascinating, and I touch on it in my book because it's relevant. There, St. Bonaparte Parish was probably one of the most diverse places in the late 1700s, with so many different groups converging together.
And that's part of why I bring it up. And also, as you and I talked about before, I need to do a separate episode about that population and the impact here, because I think people don't know about them.
Yeah, I have recommendations of people that would love to dive into that history. A good friend of mine, Samantha Perez, wrote an entire book on the Isleños.
So I'll lean on you to help me set that up, and we'll do it. So you have this, the Spanish population. In fact, you can still hear, we're losing it, but the dialect and the Spanish speaking here. So you have that population here in St. Bernard. But then as we start to think about the 1850s and 60s, let's maybe start first nationally and then we'll bring it back to St. Bernard Parish. So talk us through a little bit about, you have Abraham Lincoln, who incidentally we did an episode about Lincoln visiting New Orleans in his younger days. We did that with Richard Campanella. But you have Lincoln rising to the presidency, you have the Civil War, Lincoln's assassinated, and so we're right into that. What's the significance of 1868, and what's the sort of national culture like at that time?
Right. Well, just prior to the Civil War, the United States, slavery was still legal in various states, and contrary to some opinions, it was on the rise. There was over 4 million people locked in bondage in 1860, And parishes like St. Bernard Parish, which was largely agricultural, it was along the Mississippi River, so there was it was lined with plantations, was a population, a parish where the majority of people were enslaved, over 50% were enslaved. And that happened all around in different parishes in Louisiana and, sure. and across the South, where black people made up the majority. After the Civil War, obviously the South loses, but other things happened quickly after the Civil War. And in Louisiana, we had black male suffrage. So black people gained the right to vote, black males. And that changed the political trajectory of the political landscape of many of these parishes, including St. Bernard Parish, which was heavily Democratic before the Civil War. And then once black male suffrage came into existence, started to turn into a Republican stronghold. Now, obviously, those terms mean something very different back then, but the Republican Party was founded to stop the spread of slavery. So when they gained that right to vote, they voted in the Republican Constitution of 1868, which was arguably one of the most progressive constitutions in the South. They voted in Governor Henry Warmoth. He was a Republican, mm-hmm. youngest governor in Louisiana history. So there was a lot of black representation during Reconstruction that we wouldn't see again until after the Civil Rights Movement. We had the first black governor, PBS Pinchback. We wouldn't see another black governor in the United States until Wilder was elected in 1990. So it was a time where the landscape was changing dramatically, especially in places like St. Bernard Parish.
And so for listeners, well, a couple of things. The easiest way to think about the Republican-Democrat is to switch what you think of today, right? So fundamentally, if you think about a quote-unquote typical Democratic perspective today, that would have been Republican.
Exactly.
So as you mentioned, the Republican Party was formed, in essence, to stop the spread of slavery, but not to abolish slavery.
Right. That didn't become a goal until during the Civil War when they realized the South was not, you know, giving up. But it was designed to stop the spread of slavery, which inevitably would lead to less representation for slave-owning states as they couldn't expand west.
And so that's why it would have been, in part, such a big political issue here.
Right.
Because on the one hand, you could say, well, they were going to stop slavery, but if you're a white, upper-class plantation owner,
right.
you're thinking, well, that's no good because mm-hmm. we're going to lose political clout.
Right.
Among other things.
Yeah, even before Lincoln's inauguration, states were leaving the Union in 1860.
Sure.
In 1861. So yeah, it was a lot on the line.
So you have in St. Bernard Parish, it's a majority black parish.
Mm-hmm.
Black men now have the right to vote.
Right.
They're very numerous. The plantations were dependent on that source of labor that's now gone. And not only is it gone, but those voters are active voters.
Right.
So they're changing laws and people who are put into office very quickly. Mm-hmm. And you have all of that tension here in St. Bernard set against this election nationally.
Right.
So walk us through a little bit of what that election was about and who the players were, the presidential election.
Right. I want to emphasize your point about it being also an economic issue mm-hmm. because when Union boats were coming up the Mississippi River, the enslaved population in many places, like in the Milledon Plantation, they were leaving in droves.
Mm.
And so people were writing in newspapers that it looked like a stampede. People were just, you know, as soon as they could, the first opportunity, they were trying to exercise their economic rights as well. But the election of 1868, as you were saying, was a chaotic election. It was between two candidates. First, you had Ulysses S. Grant, which we know very well
sure.
because he won. He was the famous Union general. He was liked by the black population across the United States. And then you had Horatio Seymour. Horatio Seymour was the Democratic governor of New York. So he was on the Democratic ticket. And he labeled himself the white man's candidate. And he said that after he promised if he were to win, he would end federal occupation of the South and return the South to home rule. Well, a lot of historians like Eric Fallner, who's a famous Reconstruction historian, they, you know, claim that home rule is just a euphemism for white supremacy.
Because the moment the Federals pulled out, then it would essentially revert back.
Exactly, and revert back to the laws that it had prior to the Civil War. Mm-hmm. It would put the same planter class back into power, remove Republicans from power. So it was really that election that white Democrats felt that they had the need to suppress the black vote so they can guarantee a Seymour victory.
So that was a crazy time with a lot to lose for right. all sides. So when you draw that back to New Orleans and St. Bernard Parish, what's interesting to me, and you discuss it in your book, is, and there are similarities to today, you had this wealthy, elite, white, largely white population really getting poor, uneducated white folks
right.
fired up about this. And so the idea was that they would be threatened by this large population right. of newly freed African Americans.
Right. The economy was in shambles after the Civil War, and a lot of poor whites were also having a tough mm-hmm. time. And they were told that it was the fault, their tough times were due to the freed people exercising their rights. They received all this, you know, racialized propaganda through newspapers, through town meetings that were being hosted by wealthy Democrats who were trying to get poorer whites to be upset with freed people. So they would take it out on those groups
sure.
instead of what was really happening. You know, it's a tale that is all through, you know, woven in throughout United States history. And I think what terrified the planter class, and even throughout history, would be the solidarity between white workers and black workers. When they organize together, mm-hmm. it often terrifies the powers that be, because that means they would obviously change the entire political landscape. So that was something that they could not have happened. But there were some episodes where it did happen, even in St. Bernard Parish. I write about some people organizing across racial lines.
Right, and you go into a fair amount of detail there where there were multiple sides of this, and there was lots of organization, which caused all of this to sort of boil.
Right.
So then you get into the summer of 1868, and the massacre takes place in October of 1868. So we're right there at the sort of the crucible, the election, the fall. And again, we're recording this right before that anniversary in mid-September of 2019. And we're recording it here in St. Bernard Parish. Mm-hmm. I think you might have mentioned the middle school where you taught was right on the grounds of where
right.
much of this happened. We're not far from there.
Right.
So 1868 comes along. We hit October. And your book sort of talks through the viewpoint of one person in particular. So let's talk about that, and then we'll expand it out to sort of the whole conflict, if you will.
Right.
Or not conflict, but massacre. So let's talk about, why did you choose the person who, let's introduce him to the
right. Well, the motive for a lot of the white Democrats was voter suppression. Hmm. But within that motive, throughout the massacre, it became something much larger. It became a targeted attempt to just attack black people in general. And I zoom in on a man named Lewis Wilson. Lewis Wilson was going to New Orleans, and he was coming back to St. Bernard Parish. And he was approached by a white mob who forced him to get off his horse. And eventually they took him hostage. And he was kind of unsure of what was going on. He wasn't radical or anything. And they took him to a coffee shop, which they turned into a prison. So they were creating makeshift prisons. And Lewis Wilson tells his story. It's a dramatic story. At one point when the sun was going down, him and other people that were in his newfound makeshift prison were dragged into the streets and were executed. Hmm. Lewis Wilson survived that execution, and he crawled into some bushes to get away. They came up behind him, shot him, and then he survived again, and he stayed, and he hid for 3 days until he felt it was safe to come out. And I picked his story because, well, one, he survived, and he had the opportunity to tell his story to a man named Lieutenant Lee, who was a Union, he was an Army official who was tasked by the Freedmen's Bureau to come and get testimonies about what happened. And Lewis Wilson gives his testimony. And while he gives his testimony, he still has the bullets lodged in him, and he's requesting to go to a hospital. He wants to leave. So it was a really touching story. I was reading it, and I kept thinking, I can't believe this is happening. But I also picked him because I teach so many students who live where Lewis Wilson lived, who have the last name Wilson, who go to the same church that Lewis Wilson that was built around that time that a lot of the descendants of the survivors attend. So it actually brought it home a little bit. I was teaching students with the last name of Wilson who are from that area. I can't make the 100% connection because a lot of records were always getting lost, especially within the black community. They weren't kept very well and they were destroyed often and whatnot. Of course, that's because the slavers didn't want to have those records too exact or whatnot. But I'm almost positive that that lineage is traced from Lewis Wilson.
Well, and today you teach at Chalmette High School,
right?
Which is where the book was released in 2017. But you were doing the research while you were teaching at the middle school, and even today you were saying that you get students with the last names from sort of both sides
in the same classroom who are friends with each other and know each other, and it's interesting to see a last name of someone who's a perpetrator and a last name of someone who's a victim working in groups together. So yeah, it's a fascinating thing, and they don't even know it half the time until later in the year when I mention it or talk about it.
Well, and you and I were talking, we both grew up, you grew up here, I grew up in New Orleans, and had no idea about this story.
Right.
You know, I've done now almost 100 episodes, and until just a few months ago when I found your book, I didn't even know that this was a thing,
right?
And so I can't imagine living in the community, and in some cases living almost on the exact land, and then realizing you have a name that your ancestors go back into that time.
Right. I didn't hear about it until I was reading a book called Reconstruction in the Cane Fields by an author historian named John C. Rodrigue. And it was a footnote that said in 1868 there were disturbances in St. Bernard Parish. From there, I decided to pursue and dig in and talk with people who were familiar with it and try to get the oral history of those, because there's still a story that has passed down from generations from the 1860s that's told in the black community in Lower St. Bernard Parish. So it's out there, but it's not in any textbooks or, you know, any big works or whatnot. So it was fascinating to try to unravel what happened and then try to figure out why it was buried, why people did not want the story to get out. Even the people who tell the oral history were told not to repeat it and not to mention it. So it was interesting because, like you said, I'm from St. Bernard Parish. My mom taught history in St. Bernard Parish for over 40 years. She's never heard of it. A lot of people had no idea that this occurred.
To go back to Wilson, so he talks to this one guy, Lee, from the Freedmen's Bureau, who spends basically an afternoon or a day here. So he's investigating, but he's spending a day.
Not even. He comes for a few hours and he talks to a few people. No white people would talk to him. But he hears these stories and he realizes that he needs to get out of St. Bernard Parish, that it's still fresh, you know, it's a month in. So he does not investigate for a very long time. He talks to a few people and then he leaves.
Sure.
And he writes a report. And that report's the best piece of information we have on the St. Bernard Parish massacre. Luckily, there are government records because Congress also investigated later and whatnot to see if the election here was legitimate. So if it wasn't for that, there's no telling how many stories are out there that have been buried or that we don't know about.
Sure.
You know?
Either I heard or saw some tape of another discussion you had about this and the idea that there were probably, almost certainly, hundreds of massacres across the South and probably hundreds in Louisiana that the records are just essentially lost. And I want to kind of get into the story even a little bit more, but one of the other things, as you were saying that, and we're sitting here, is this area was destroyed by Hurricane Katrina, but also by Hurricane Betsy.
Right.
And I don't know if it's in your book or if you were talking in another interview about those. You had the suppression of records and in some cases not even keeping records.
Right.
But then what records we did have didn't survive one or both of those hurricanes. So then by the time you come back and start digging into it, the history that we have documented is far less than probably the limited amount that did exist at one point.
You're exactly right. And I was born after Betsy and in high school when Katrina hit. So obviously I wasn't doing a lot of research. And I talked to the St. Bernard Parish historian, William Hyland, who works at the Isleños Museum down the road. And he talked about records that he saw before Katrina that are no longer there about these events. So there's a ton of records that just were lost to nature.
Sure.
You know, but also, like you said, they weren't kept. They were purposefully discarded. So it was a lot of you know, a digging
yeah.
to do.
So we talked about Wilson and the other three men that were there with him and were executed, but somewhere between 36 and maybe 100 people were right. murdered through that period of time, just really a fairly short period of a few days, right?
Right. The low estimate that I found was 35. And that wasn't from Lieutenant Lee's report. It was from the judge at the time and federal government reports. And the judge at the time said it was at least 35, but he believes it was in the 60s, the death toll. The oral history that I heard from one lady who's a descendant of the survivors was that she tells a story that people were lynched and her family would go and, you know, cut the rope and bury them. And that was it. There was no one coming to see who it was. And I'm sure that happened quite frequently. So I would say 35 is a conservative estimate considering what I've read and what I've heard.
And it was the culmination of sort of this structured terrorism
right.
against this population here in St. Bernard. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely. It was terrorism by any definition of the word. Yeah.
And you, I should have mentioned in your book, you kind of break down. So we walk through kind of a history and context, but you take readers through, before you get to this actual event that we're discussing, you talk about colonization and antebellum and then the escalation, and you really do sort of lead up to why, as bad as this incident is, how it happens or why it happens. And it seems to me that in your book, you talk about that's not really the end of it because
right.
there's this huge impact, right? So if you could right. talk to us a little bit about, so not only does it terrorize this community, but
right.
but what's the aftermath of that?
Well, within the massacre itself, there were a lot of killings, obviously, of the black population. But there was one guy who was killed in retaliation. But there's two narratives to this story that I found. But a local man named Pablo Falu was killed in retaliation because apparently he was shooting black people that were passing by his home. Mm-hmm. But one story says that black people were antagonizing him, trying to get whiskey. The other story says that he was riled up because of what was happening. And, you know, he was getting amped at what
sure.
the political and racial climate at the time. Whatever the case may be, he killed freed people, and freed people retaliated, killed him, and burned down his house. What happened next became, it was the catalyst to intensify the killings, because now white Democrats had a martyr. Hmm. They had somebody that they could point to and say, look what happened. And the story of Pablo Falu went across the country, and the people, newspapers all across the country were writing on it. And I have a quote from the New York Herald, which wrote on Pablo Falu's murder. And this is all the way in New York, writing about St. Bernard Parish, little old St. Bernard Parish. The New York Herald stated, quote, "The blacks wreaked their demonic vengeance on the innocent and helpless, burning three houses and killing a man and woman. It is believed 5 children." So the story was passed on that these people killed a man, a wife, and their 5 children, burned them alive. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that wasn't the case. I actually talked to Falu's descendants, and the children and the wife escaped.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this story really got the white Democrats upset. And the next day, they went on a rampage and killing. After the killing subsided, which was a few days after, also, the killing was after the election as well. So once mm-hmm. the election ended, they went around to try to find out, you know, who voted and how did they vote? Because one person voted for Grant, which was interesting, despite the fact that the majority voted for so many Republican initiatives prior to this election. So I always thought it'd be fascinating to go back in time and talk to this
right.
one person. Like, you went in and voted and survived. So they were looking for people who they suspected could have been that one person.
Hmm.
So they killed people that, after the election, that didn't vote or said they voted for the Democratic ticket, it didn't matter. But after the killing subsided, what happened was one man named Felipe Toca, who declared himself judge, even though he wasn't elected, he decided to arrest as many freed people as possible for the killing of Pablo Falu. And what we saw was not one white person was arrested, but hundreds of freed people were arrested and transported to New Orleans, and some stayed in there for months until they can pay their way out or until a judge can help them out. So the retaliation for Falou's murder, which was one on the other side,
right,
was really extreme. People were imprisoned for incredibly long periods of time for a murder, which was essentially in retaliation for what Falou did. So it left a legacy of not just, it left a legacy of if you, you know, challenge the system, the questioning wasn't an option at the time, questioning the structure that was there. So obviously Seymour carried St. Bernard Parish, but the federal government did an investigation and rendered it null and void because it wasn't run by the actual police jury. The police jury were either murdered or they fled, but they were supposed to be the legal body in charge of the election. I'm actually in contact with one of the descendants of the police jury, which she came to me after the book was written. But so it's really fascinating, and the legacy is definitely there. In fact, there's only one historical marker for this atrocity, and it's Pablo Falou's grave, his tombstone in St. Bernard Cemetery. His tombstone says, it reads, Pablo San Falou, assassinated by slaves, incited by carpetbag rule, died October 1869, which is a fascinating tombstone.
It seems like almost all of that is a lie.
All of it's a lie. All of it. In fact, there's nowhere in records where the name San comes in, but in Spanish it means saint. So they were trying to deify him a bit, make him a martyr, which they felt he was. It says that he was assassinated, so they try to give him some importance, right? If you know, when people are assassinated, it's usually they're considered important people. If not, it's just a murder. And then it says by slaves. Well, these people were no longer enslaved. So either two conclusions happened. They did not, the people who erected the marker did not know slavery ended, or they knew it but didn't recognize these people's right to be out of slavery. It claimed that it was, the murder was incited by carpetbag rule, so they were blaming a lot of white Republicans for inciting what they felt was were free people, you know, acting out of turn or whatnot. And it claimed that he died in October 1869,
which, a year later.
Yeah, so it's just that the date's just wrong. So it was obviously erected much later.
So all that's the only tangible sign we have related to this massacre.
Yes.
And yet every line of it's incorrect.
Exactly.
And that you can go see that in the St. Bernard Cemetery.
Right.
But there's no marker, there's no historical marker, there's no sort of counter explanation of it.
Yet. But yet. That's something that I hope within the next few years we can get a more accurate historical marker, you know, near where it took place to give some sort of, to give the victims some sort of dignity. You know, I don't know the right word there because what can you do? But something to say that these people existed, they lived, and they died simply because the color of their skin, you know?
Well, in your book, it was sort of, for me, one aha moment after another, and we've tried to set the context here of this was such a charged environment.
Right.
And you mentioned TOCA later. You had people acting as judges that weren't elected. You had police juries and then sort of pseudo juries. You had conflicting organizations popping up that had no real authority except by sort of mob rule, if you will. And then when this explodes, you have some people trying to help people and then they're attacked.
Right.
You tell a story where people are trying to take shelter in a large home, and then that comes under attack.
Right.
And more people are killed. And it's real, the book is fascinating to me because it just immerses you in, it's not one event per se.
Right.
It's this sort of period of terror and this after effect that they, even after the election, so even after the politics go the way the elite want them to, it's still not enough.
Right.
There's still paybacks, and the impression I get from the book is to make sure that people understand that lesson.
Right.
So that not only does 1868 come, but it's going to have an impact quite into the future.
Exactly. You know, when the Union took over New Orleans in 1862, they set up their own Louisiana government. So Louisiana had two competing governments throughout the Civil War, and you see that theme even during Reconstruction, when white Democrats want to get rid of these Republican-dominated governments and revert back to home rule. And that's what was happening in St. Bernard Parish. But you're absolutely right about white Republicans being a target as well. They were often seen as carpetbaggers, which is a derogatory term given to people that came from the North to try to, they were believed that they were trying to reap the spoils of war. So, you know, the Southern whites did not like whom they called carpetbaggers. But there were people that moved into St. Bernard Parish, took over plantations, paid workers a fair wage. And those people were a target as well. In fact, one of them did board up his plantation and sent for help. He sent a guy by the name of Mike Curtis, who was a Union war vet. And Mike Curtis often bragged about all the battles he fought in, apparently. And a lot of people were angry with him. Well, he was sent to try to get help. And on his way, one of the white mobs stopped him and, after a scuffle, brutally killed him. And the people who tried to bury him, the freed people who came and tried to bury him, were killed as well. So they were sending a clear message. But you're right, it reverberated throughout history, all into the late 19th century, into the 20th century, because Reconstruction ended in 1877 because of the Compromise of 1877. Rutherford B. Hayes decided to, in order for him to get the election or to get the presidency, mm-hmm. he pulled federal troops out of the South. So the South was reverting back to home rule through their campaigns of intimidation. Obviously, black representation dwindled, and Louisiana reverted back to what we call it the Bourbon era. They were reverting back to a lot of their laws that were passed before the Civil War. We had the Black Codes, which simply stated that black people could not, they had to work on their former plantations. And if they didn't, they would be arrested and then forced to go to work. So Louisiana did revert back to home rule, and in part because of the St. Bernard Parish Massacre and other massacres. You know, it was happening throughout Louisiana. So it was, you know, if you wanted to vote in the 1860s, late 1860s, early 1870s, you're essentially putting your life on the line.
Well, and this was sort of one of the central sort of aftermath themes in the book to me is, on some level, on a national stage, 1868 was unsuccessful for those folks that wanted to go back to home rule. But right. In places like New Orleans and St. Bernard Parish in particular, where no one, I think you said one person, voted for Grant, it laid the groundwork for when mm-hmm. Hayes comes along a decade later. What had happened here in St. Bernard Parish blossoms across the country. And ultimately, there's enough of a compromise and enough of a deal that the white people, the wealthy elite, get what they want in the South.
Exactly. And it's in part, too, to the North. Actually, they were losing interest in Reconstruction because the Panic of 1873 put the United States into a depression. And the Reconstruction government, dominated by Republicans, were trying to build schools, and they were trying to build roads, and they were allocating land. Well, all this takes taxes, and so they became unpopular in that regard. One way Reconstruction was taught was that it was these governments, they were just being corrupt, and that's why it didn't work out. So a lot of white Southerners would say, you see what happens when you give blacks the ability to represent themselves, it turns into corruption. But in reality, it was much more complicated than that, and we look at Reconstruction differently today. But white Northerners also abandoned the idea of Reconstruction because the country fell into a depression, and it was exhausting because of all the battles that they were fighting. They lost that interest and pulled out, and they left essentially black Southerners to fend for themselves in many cases, in many regards.
And when all of that happens, then it leads to directly to the Jim Crow era.
Exactly.
And then you're all the way into the mid-1960s.
Right.
Before there's a serious address against that. And then here you are today.
Right. So, when they returned back to home rule, they passed laws that said that you had to pay to vote. They had a grandfather clause. They were given tests, and I give my students some of these tests to see if they would have been allowed to vote. Mm. And the tests are so arbitrary. You can just pick and choose who who you want to vote and whatnot, to show them how difficult these tests were. But yes, you get into Jim Crow, and it's not until the 1960s, which some historians call the Civil Rights Movement the Second Reconstruction, because it's trying to live up to so many ideals that the Reconstruction governments were promising. And it wasn't until the 1960s that you saw Black Americans get in the representation that they had during Reconstruction.
It was just fascinating to me as I read about this story I didn't even know. Mm-hmm. And again, you mentioned you didn't know until a certain point. And these themes are repeated even today. You hear the things about economics and immigrants, right, and minority populations. And one event like this can trigger this impact, mm-hmm, that just has these ripples throughout time and across geography.
Right, right.
And that's why I thought it was so important. The book is so well done, Chris. And I would encourage people, we'll have links to it over at beyondbourbonst.com, our website. We'll put the show notes where people can find a link to buy the book, as well as you talk about other subjects as well on your website, chrisdeer.com, mm-hmm, and people can follow you on Twitter as well, and we'll put all that over there. But for anybody that's interested in history, I think the book is amazing on so many levels. Again, you got this very distilled, very specific place downriver from New Orleans, but then you can see how not only this event, this massacre, but others like it, mm-hmm, could have influenced the way our country is today.
Right, right. And it's a story that's still being told. I'm not finished with it. I feel like I want to do an updated version. I found more information. I want to do more research, and I want to continue to build on it, you know, but that's a long time coming. But it's a story that has captured me and captured the attention of so many people, but it's also not atypical in the United States. And that's something that growing up, I didn't realize in history classes how prevalent massacres like this were. So I feel like as a history teacher, and I think a lot of history teachers are starting to feel this way, we need to teach history in a way that is more accurate and representative of all Americans. And I think this story attempts to do that.
What has been the reaction? So again, when you started, you were at the St. Bernard Middle School. When the book was published, you were at your present place at Chalmette High. Long history there at Chalmette High, proud, rich history there, mm-hmm, diverse population,
right,
as is the parish at large. What has been the reaction both of your students and the community to your book and to the discussion in this way of, mm-hmm, sort of challenging history?
Overwhelmingly positive. In fact, so St. Bernard Parish is becoming more and more diverse. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of people from New Orleans moving in. We have immigrant populations that came after Katrina to help rebuild, that stayed, and we see that chain migration. So our school, Chalmette High, has a really diverse population, which is great because we can have so many conversations that are much needed to be had, especially in today's climate. I would say the reactions are overwhelmingly positive. People are interested. They want to know, especially the students. They want to know, you know, a side of history that might not have been told to them. You know, they might be discovering or figuring stuff out. There has been some negative pushback. People writing saying it's not the right time, or you should have waited before you publish, or it's not the right climate. I've heard things like that. But obviously, people with that mindset, I strongly disagree with them because when is the right time?
Sure.
You know, and it's mostly white people who have said those things because they fear there might be some backlash if history comes out and whatnot. So it just kind of, you get into their perceptions of other people based on their critiques. Mm-hmm. But I think it was way past time. This happened in 1868, you know? So, but overwhelmingly it has been positive. I did book signings throughout the parish. I hosted a lecture at Nunez. Over 100 people attended, which surprised me, but I was really happy to see that interest. But I would say my students probably are the most interested because I have this on display, so I like it when they walk by it and they pick it up and start reading it. And sometimes I don't even tell them it's my work until
interesting
later.
Right.
Yeah. And they might say, what? It's the same last name as you.
Well, it really is interesting because of all those layers to me. I mean, when I picked it up, I was thinking this is going to be about one event, and it really isn't, as hopefully we've conveyed to the listener today, that it's really just a snippet of time, both in geography and across time.
Right.
Because you could, again, probably find hundreds, if not thousands, of things like this across our country.
Right. The first two chapters are just the historic context before I even get into the massacre. So you can get an idea of the landscape, the geography, the groups who settled. And then I get into the massacre. And, you know, the last chapter or two is about the repercussions of the massacre. And it goes all over, you know. It's it was huge. It was monumental. And you're right. This is not something that was random or just happened in St. Bernard Parish, but all throughout Louisiana, throughout the South, and throughout the United States. So I hope I conveyed that as well in the book, because it's a grand story.
Well, history is often uncomfortable and often not what we learned in school, right?
Right. And I feel like being raised by a history teacher, I don't feel that as much sometimes. Mm. So I just start talking, and then all of a sudden people are like, well, and they get real heated. And I'm like, oh, okay. I was raised listening to my mom just blabble on about history, and this is what happened. It happened. She had that mentality. So, but you're right. It is controversial, especially things regarding race or class, politics.
One of the great lessons for me as I am right around 100 episodes of Beyond Bourbon Street is how many of my own beliefs and understanding of history have been challenged just through the process of meeting authors and historians and people with interesting stories about this place that we call home. And again, I'm just very thankful that you wrote the book. I'm very thankful that you and I met. We will put links to it. Again, it's called The 1868 St. Bernard Parish Massacre, Blood in the Cane Fields. We'll make that available to people, Chris, so that they can get educated and they can read and learn a little bit more about our history. Thank you so much for taking the time to share this with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Mark.
I'm thankful I got the chance to talk with Chris and to learn about the events of 1868. As I mentioned at the start, I grew up here and I had never heard of the massacre in St. Bernard. No one I mentioned it to had heard of it either. Today's episode was brought to you by my friends at the Old Number 77 Hotel. I didn't want to interrupt the discussion with Chris, but I do want to tell you why I think the Old 77 is a great choice for your next visit to New Orleans. First, it's in a great location in the Warehouse District, just 3 blocks from the French Quarter. It's close to lots of great places to eat and drink, and it's near the streetcar lines, too. They also have a great rotating art exhibit that's free, and it's put together by Where You Art. This is especially fitting since the area near the hotel is now sometimes called the Arts District. The Old Number 77 has 167 rooms, small enough to feel cozy, but still lots of choices. They have interior rooms for those of you that don't want any hint of daylight after a long night out. They also offer premium rooms and artist loft suites curated by New Orleans artists. The Old 77's home to an award-winning restaurant, Chef Nina Compton's Compère Le Pen. And here's an insider's tip. Go during happy hour and order a couple small plates. I love to order an old-fashioned and pair it with a side of biscuits. The Old Number 77 is located at 535 Chapatula Street. Use code BBOLD77 when you book a room and save 25%. Plus, you get a bit of lagniappe, a little something extra, in the form of a $10 credit at Tootlaw for coffee and pastries in the morning. Thanks for joining me today. If you want to buy a copy of Chris's book or connect with him, the links will be in the show notes over at beyondbourbonst.com/100.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone who loves New Orleans. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.